Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an assessment of what the secrets might be that were cherry-picked from the NSA's computers by Edward Snowden before he took them abroad on his computers and on his thumb drives, and whether the Chinese and the Russians have already downloaded them. James Bamford, an investigative journalist who specializes in national security issues and wrote two books about the NSA, The Puzzle Palace and The Shadow Factory, Inside the Ultra-Secret NSA from 9/11 to Spying on America, joins us to discuss the damage control now going on at the NSA. Then, with the American fugitive Edward Snowden apparently delayed in Moscow on his way to Cuba, then on to Ecuador, where he has asked for political asylum, we will look into the possibility that Snowden is being debriefed by the SVR, the Russian foreign intelligence successor to the KGB. A veteran reporter on intelligence, Richard Sale, joins us to discuss what might be going on in Moscow as the U.S. government warns Russian leaders not to jeopardize relations between the two countries by aiding and abetting a fugitive. Then finally, with WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange holed up in Ecuador's London embassy, and with representatives of WikiLeaks escorting Edward Snowden on his way to asylum in Ecuador, we will examine the state of press freedom in Ecuador and how that gels with the mission of WikiLeaks, a group that champions freedoms of the press and open access to government secrets. Carlos Loria, the Senior Americas Program Coordinator at the Committee to Protect Journalists who monitors press freedoms in the Americas, joins us. And joining us now is James Bamford, who's an investigative journalist specializing in national security issues. He was the Washington investigative reporter for ABC's World News Tonight and is the author of the best-selling books Body of Secrets, The Puzzle Palace, A Pretext for War, 9/11 Iraq, and the Abuse of American Intelligence Agencies, and The Shadow Factory, Inside the Ultra-Secret NSA, from 9/11 to Spying on America. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Bamford.
Well, thanks, Ian. Good to be here.
And there was a bit of a, I guess, an amusing incident took place at the Moscow airport this morning when a whole bunch of journalists, about two dozen of them, bought tickets on the Monday flight to Havana, which cost them more than $2,000 each for the round trip. And they were dismayed when the seat in row 17 that was assigned to Edward Snowden remained empty as the plane took off. And one can only hope they have a few mojitos in Havana, I guess.
And a few cigars, maybe.
So what are we to make about the whereabouts of Edward Snowden, who is being accompanied by Sarah Harrison, who's a top WikiLeaks lieutenant, apparently a confidant of Julian Assange's. Assange has said in a telephone conference with members of the press today that Snowden's in a safe place and that his spirits are high, but he only would say that he was bound for Ecuador via a safe path through Russia and other states. So, given that the U.S. seems to be leaning on Russia and he hasn't left Russia as far as anybody knows, do you think there's a possibility that the Russians might hand him over?
If I was to bet on this, I would say no, I don't think they will, because they do have a number of outs to use in place of giving him back. First of all, they could claim that he's not technically on Russian territory, since he apparently didn't have a Russian visa, has not left the transit lounge, and so therefore they could say he's just somebody in transit and not technically entered Russia. The other reason is that first of all, we don't have an extradition treaty with Russia. So there's no real obligation, legal obligation, to turn him over. And the third reason is that even countries that have extradition treaties, part of the extradition treaty is that the person be charged with a crime that's also a crime in the country they're seeking to extradite him from. And, you know, turning NSA secrets over to the press is not a crime in Russia. And, you know, if there's a fourth reason, it's that extradition can be avoided if the country determines that the charge is political, and since Snowden is claiming asylum, they could claim that this is a political crime and not a not murder, theft, hijacking, that kind of thing.
And, of course, the Russians are not very happy with the United States for refusing to their repeated request to return Victor Boot, the convicted global arms smuggler who was sentenced to 25 years in prison here last year. But apparently Assange is traveling on a document that was issued by Ecuador that was facilitated.
You mean, not Assange, but
I'm sorry, I mean Snowden, that was arranged by WikiLeaks, that the Ecuadorians have provided him with a refugee document of passage, and that's how he left Hong Kong, and that's the paperwork that he has in terms of Moscow. The U.S., of course, have revoked Snowden's passport, which they did rather late, too. That's kind of surprising, isn't it?
Well, how hard is it to cancel a passport?
Yeah, it's a phone call.
They didn't feel a necessity for canceling it because they knew he was in Hong Kong, but I don't know, maybe nobody told White House there's a thing called airplanes that people can get on and fly other places. I mean, one of the more dramatic ways this may end is if there is a swap where the Russians get the man that they want, Victor Boot, and the Obama administration gets the man they want.
Well, that is a real possibility. I brought up Victor Boot's name for that reason, because it struck me that they clearly want him, and he worked closely with the KGB or the SVR, and Putin apparently has personally intervened on a number of occasions.
That was a very regular occurrence. Well, not regular, but fairly unique occurrences that would take place every few years between Russia and the U.S. during the Cold War. And they would catch a spy, we'd catch a spy, and the two would be exchanged.
On the famous bridge.
That's right.
In
yeah,
Berlin,
exactly.
Yeah. So, again, I'm speaking with James Bamford, an investigative journalist specializing in national security issues. He was the Washington investigative reporter for ABC's World News Tonight, and is the author of the best-selling books Body of Secrets, The Puzzle Palace, A Pretext for War, 9/11 Iraq and the Abuse of American Intelligence Agencies, and The Shadow Factory, Inside the Ultra-Secret NSA from 9/11 to Spying on America. Now, what is Edward Snowden carrying with him? He's got what, four computers and a bunch of thumb drives. According to the interview he did in the South China Morning Post, that he chose the job at Booz Allen because he wanted to collect information, and that he cherry picked a whole bunch of information before he left. Do we know? I mean, I guess, you know, NSA is probably doing some damage control now, but do they know what this guy's what he has on his computers and his thumb drives?
Well, it's been sort of Keystone Cops all along from the very beginning here. They weren't able to detect what he was doing in the first place, even though they had the experience of Bradley Manning, who managed to walk out of Army intelligence offices with nearly a million documents, something like 700,000 documents on CD-ROMs. And they were supposed to have corrected the situation after that, so that's not possible. And here, you know, just a year or so, a couple of years afterwards, they have the Snowden case. And Snowden had plenty of time and also plenty of access to get what he wanted because he had, I guess it was 3 or 3.5 months or something like that at Booz Allen. And he was also a what was called a systems administrator, which is probably apparently the job that he really wanted. That's sort of like in the 60s or whatever, would be the guy walking around with 5 pounds worth of keys hanging from his belt. He's the person that, except now it would be all digital keys, they'd be passwords and so forth. So he's a person with a digital key to everything, and whether or not they could tell what he took depends on how well they're able to do audit on his entry into different computer files and different areas within the agency's most classified sections. He being a fairly skilled systems administrator, he may also have found a way to hide his audit trail, which may be why they didn't catch him in the first place, and may make it quite more difficult to find him after the fact.
So, given that he was this IT guy, and my understanding is that foreign intelligence people look for guys like him because of the very reason. Are you satisfied that there's no way in the world that he was recruited by anybody before he left? And a lot of people are suspicious that he went to Hong Kong. He would have gone there knowing that, you know, having some kind of arrangement with the Chinese in advance.
No, if this was going to be a foreign intelligence operation, what they they could have done sort of the similar thing. They would have had him extract all that classified material. But then they would have had him come down with some disease, make up some reason to leave the agency or sign up for college or go someplace else to work. They would have done something or just kept him there. I mean, they would have done something to prevent anybody from knowing what documents he took out. This could not have been an intelligence operation, because one of the key aspects of an intelligence operation is that the person you're stealing the documents from doesn't know that you're stealing the documents, because once they know what documents that you've stolen, then they could change the whatever the systems are. So I really doubt that. I think it is just on its face what it is. It's a person who was not attuned to the government's eavesdropping on U.S. citizens. I interviewed people like that for a variety of my books, and I did a cover story for Wired magazine last year. I interviewed Bill Binney, a former senior NSA official who'd been there almost 40 years and basically designed the entire eavesdropping system, and he had the same views and pretty much told me the same thing that Edward Snowden has released. In my Wired magazine article, I write about, I quote Benny telling me about how they got access to all of Verizon's metadata and all the access to the Internet and so forth. The difference was he didn't have documents. He just told me about it. Mm-hmm. And a week or so afterwards, the NSA denied a lot of that. The director came out and denied it. So, and Benny, Snowden's mentioned Benny a couple of times, and I think in the context that's the problem, you know, if you just come out and you're just a whistleblower. All the NSA does is deny it, and then the mainstream media largely just adopts whatever the NSA says. So the only way to really prove what's going on is to bring out the proof, bring out the documents. So I think he saw what happened in the past with other whistleblowers, and he didn't want to be one of these people that they just lied their way out of.
Well, already a couple of the senators, Ron Wyden and Mark Udall, have called on the director of the National Security Agency, General Alexander, who's testified, saying that there was a significant inaccuracy in the fact sheet about the agency's use of the law that underpins its internet surveillance program. And already, of course, Clapper essentially lied. The director of National Intelligence lied to the senators in a public hearing after the Guardian revealed that the NSA does indeed collect records of every phone call made in the United States. Clapper was forced to admit that he had given the least untruthful response he could. So that seems to be the way they operate. You know, they tell as little as they could possibly get away with in terms of...
He may say least untruthful. I say most untruthful. I mean, you can put spin on anything, and that sounds like something that comes out of Orwell or something, some newspeak, least untruthful.
Right.
It was a lie. It was simply a lie. The he was asked whether the NSA keeps records on millions of or surveillance files on millions of Americans, and he said no, they didn't. And that's what everybody's phone records are. Everybody's phone records goes to NSA every day, who you called, how long you were on the phone, where you called from, all that material. That's not surveillance data on Americans, I don't know what is.
But in the overall scheme of things, in terms of this NSA leak that came from Edward Snowden, which clearly has riled up the public, it's affected Obama's poll numbers, particularly with those under 30. He's had a 17-point drop in 1 month in that demographic. But is there a lot to it? I mean, in terms of the new information, I mean, it seems to me that we knew most of what came out.
Well, like I mentioned, I've written, three books on NSA, numerous articles, and last year in Wired, I quoted a number of senior former agency officials who turned into, became whistleblowers, Phil Benny, and a number of others. And they, like I said, they said basically the same thing.
Sure.
And they certainly were in a position to know. They were among the most senior people there, and that's what their job was developing this the eavesdropping system. So, it's not new. What's new, however, is to actually see the documents, to actually see a Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court order where it specifies that they want all this data from Americans every day, every phone call, even local calls. If your grandmother calls the next-door neighbor in Wichita, Kansas, they want that. And it's going to be there, and they're going to keep it, and they're going to keep it for as long as they want. So what was also surprising to me, which I didn't know, was that they were able to do this through this loophole in the Patriot Act, basically saying that under the rubric of business records, where they get all this data under a simple loophole, basically it says that they can get access to people's business records. And if you ask an average person on the street and you ask them about the business record exceptions, they would probably say, well, you know, that's if you're accused of embezzlement or whatever, then they could go in and get your bank records from the bank or whatever. Nobody would ever assume that one little phrase means you can get everybody's phone records every single day for the rest of their lives.
Right. Well, just in closing, James Bamford, The fact that there wasn't a lot new in what was released, that there was, you know, obviously a political impact of the leaks on the eve of the meeting between Obama and President Xi of China. It was revealed that the U.S. was, it was a presidential finding on Obama targeting a bunch of countries, including China. That clearly embarrassed the U.S. The leak on the eve of the G8 conference about GCHQ spying on the G20. And my understanding is that the four laptops and the thumb drives that he's got with him would be easily both the Chinese and the Russians would be able to access them. So how much has Snowden helped the United States, people of the United States, revealing stuff, and how much has he hurt the United States in terms of other less friendly countries getting hold of all this secret stuff?
Well, one of the other aspects that we hadn't mentioned is he released documents on how the U.S. is aggressively using cyber warfare, basically, to spy on the Chinese. And I just did a new cover story for Wired that coincidentally came out the same time as all this broke. It was a cover story for the July issue of Wired that looks at the it's a cover story on General Alexander, who's the director of the National Security Agency, and it looks at his role as also head of Cyber Command. So Snowden released a number of documents that shed new light also on the whole cyber war aspect of NSA and Cyber Command. But in terms of damage to the U.S., I don't really think there was really any damage to the U.S. for the public to know that the government's getting access to these records, because to these phone records, because it's their records. So they really should have a right to know what the government is doing with their private records. In addition, it can't really do any harm to national security, since I've been writing about terrorists for years and years, if not decades, and I don't think there's any terrorists out there that assumed that the U.S. wasn't eavesdropping on communications with everything that's come out about NSA. So it wouldn't be a surprise to them. It is a big surprise probably to most Americans.
But what about the idea that the Chinese and whatever these secrets that he cherry-picked, they might already be in the hands of both the Chinese and the Russians?
Well, I certainly wouldn't be surprised at that. It's very easy and fairly quick to do some forensic computer work that gives you a mirror image of what's ever on a computer. So if those, you know, he doesn't necessarily have to have known this. He didn't have to deliberately have given them his computers or hard drive or his flash drives or whatever. If he happened to have left them in a hotel room in China or wherever he was staying, that's one of the oldest tricks in the book, is to get access to a hotel room and get copy what's on a computer. So he didn't have to give that information to them. They could have easily gotten it.
Right.
And the same for the Russians, since he's passing through Moscow, and I would think one of the things that they would require is that they take a look at what he's bringing into the country and bringing out of the country and so forth. So it could be quite,
routine,
interesting. What they might have gotten from his electronic machines, whatever he was carrying.
Well, James Bamford, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with James Bamford, who's an investigative journalist specializing in national security issues. He was the Washington investigative reporter for ABC World News Tonight and is the author of the best-selling books Body of Secrets, The Puzzle Palace, A Pretext for War, 9/11, Iraq, and the Abuse of American Intelligence Agencies, and The Shadow Factory, Inside the Ultra-Secret NSA from 9/11 to Spying on America. And as he mentioned, he has the cover article in the current issue of Wired magazine. We're going to take a brief station break and be back further talking about the fate of Edward Snowden.
Listen, do you want to know a secret? Do you promise not to tell? Whoa, closer. Let me whisper in your ear. Say the words you long to hear. I'm in love with you. I've known a secret for the
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Richard Sale, who's been reporting on intelligence since the late 1970s. He was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize and is the author of Clinton's Secret Wars. He regularly posts for the blog Sic Semper Tyrannis about national security and foreign policy, and he has a recent article called Afghanistan, A Dark and Fragile Future at truthout.org. Welcome to Background Briefing, Richard Sale.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And what's your understanding of so far what has happened to whatever this cache of secrets that Edward Snowden was able to cherry pick from the NSA's computers, clearly and deliberately? I think he probably found some of the best stuff he could get his hands on, and he took it with him on, I think, four computers and a bunch of of flash drive thumb drives. And the assumption from what people I talk to in the intelligence world, they say that, of course, all that stuff's gone to both the Russians and the Chinese. Do you share that belief?
Well, first of all, I would emphasize that top secret is not that high a clearance. There are 22 clearances above top secret. So Snowden is not getting the best of the best at all. The other thing, a point I think is really important to make, is that there is the connection between surveillance programs like the National Security Agency and the whole topic of cyber warfare has not in any way made clear to the American public. I mean, how many people in the American public realize that the first U.S. cyber war weapons were deployed against the city of San Diego in a botched U.S. Navy experiment? We just don't know about these matters. They are kept secret from us.
Right. And the Israelis, didn't the Israelis hack into Air Force One?
Yeah, they did in the 1980s. They were very good. And they did it actually from their own cyber war. They had a bunch of relay stations, and they were able to do that, listening into conversations.
So what's your assessment then of what Snowden has done in terms of this issue of cyber warfare? Because the first data dump came on the eve of the talk with Obama and the president of China, and clearly having a finding from Obama saying that he was targeting China. And then you know that from the South China Morning Post article interview that Snowden did, that the People's Daily played that to the hilt, and the Chinese people are saying that how terrible the Americans are and we're the victims of cyber attacks, not the perpetrators. So it's difficult not to see that in terms of the issue of cyber warfare, what he's revealed so far has actually helped the Chinese, as far as I can tell.
It's hard to tell. I mean, clearly it's no secret that Obama has been targeting China and vice versa. There is absolutely a I don't even know how you'd call it, low-grade or certainly a medium-grade cyber war going on. It's been going on for a long time. The United States was very successful in planting computer viruses on the Soviet Union, and we were very successful in doing it planting them on Iran, and we are now trying very hard to develop sources inside China. And what we want to do is to have sources in China who will relay to the Chinese technicians faulty or inaccurate data that they will use in making poor technological decisions. That's really what is at stake here.
So in other words, they give them blueprints of phony secrets that don't work. It's a bit like the Stuxnet virus that was implanted in the centrifuges, right? That sends false signals that caused the Iranian program to be delayed. So
there was a rogue Iranian organization called the MEK that used to kill U.S. Army sergeants in Paris back in the 1970s.
Right.
And they use a diseased memory stick to infect the Iranian computers.
So tell me about then, just back to where is Edward Snowden, since he's a bunch of journalists, about 20 to 30 journalists paid $2,000.
None of us knows. I find this question amusing. None of us knows.
Right.
And all we can do is stew and speculate, but we're not adding anything to knowledge.
Right. But what about the fact that he's supposedly, and the U.S. government says he's in Russian hands, and then that raises the question of is he being debriefed by the SVR? I mean, presumably they could debrief him later when he goes to Ecuador.
Debriefings are extremely complicated and very difficult to do. I read through the debriefing of Eichmann by Israel. You have the enormous amount of knowledge that you have to use to put together a debriefing, and especially the sequence in which the questions are asked to throw the subject off the track. It's extremely delicate, very arduous, and it's very, very, very difficult to succeed in.
So clearly the U.S. is weighing in on the Russians. They're
sure.
Basically saying, hand this guy over. And we were talking earlier with James Bamford about the possibility that they may be interested in a swap to get. They've been asking. Putin's been asking for Victor Boot to be released at least 7 times.
Yeah. Well, that's there's so many. I'm not competent really to.
Sean.
No, I mean there are too many intangibles that I simply am uninformed about.
Right. Well, it's obviously a speculation because we don't know. On the other hand, Julian Assange of WikiLeaks says that Edward Snowden's in a safe place. He has high spirits, and that he is, going to be sent on his way to Ecuador soon. So.
Well, I'm sure the WikiLeaks guy on board the plane is reporting back to him. So I'm sure that's what. What he's hearing, and it may be true or not.
Well, they're not on the plane. that was what was so amusing.
I was using his. Right. I'm sure the WikiLeaks guy is able to use his cell phone, so I'm sure.
Yeah, yeah. It's a woman. That's traveling with him, Sarah Harrison. So, just in terms of what kind of a damage control is going on at the NSA, and of course, all of these people that come on television and defend the NSA are all the people that are selling us out by giving away the store to contractors, Clapper and McConnell and Hayden.
I think that the major scandal will probably, in the end, settle on the private contractors because I think their vetting procedures are extremely poor and sometimes they're inept. I don't like the amount of salaries that these people are paid in comparison with government salaries. It's a very iffy business, and it's proved terribly unreliable in the past. And in Iraq, it stuck us with a bill that could amount to $60 billion wasted. So they are not people to be trusted.
Well, it's worse than that. Bob Baer was saying that the other day, the former CIA officer saying that in the case of Snowden's contract, he was supposedly getting up to $200,000. He was lured away from the CIA by this offer. But whatever they paid him, whether Booz Allen paid him $150,000 or $200,000, they apparently then in turn charge the American taxpayer about $1 million for that contract.
Well, so, that's the way the system works, and that's why it's so horribly corrupt, and that's why. You end up with private contractors being accused of murder and rape and other things in foreign lands that they were sent there to protect.
So what's your takeaway then in terms of whether this Edward Snowden has helped the people of the United States by revealing information about how much the government's spying on them, even though the information that was revealed is not particularly new, as James Bamford had pointed out in the previous interview, and yet there's a possibility that all of these secrets have ended up in the hands of the Russians and the Chinese that he has with him, and that he's off to Ecuador, essentially being sheltered by a guy who basically is at war with the press in his own country, in Ecuador.
I think Snowden's a grandstander. I think he's an anti-American, I think he's a very callow young man, and I don't think he has any principles. I think he wants to get himself talked about, which is the disease of a young person. So that's what he suffers from, I believe.
Well, but he may be more naive than mendacious, though, surely.
I agree with that, yeah.
I mean, he may just not realize how deep he is in
the magnitude of his stuff. It doesn't do anybody any good at all. But I just think that the listeners should realize that we are living in an environment where intelligence has to be collected, and it hopefully it has to be sound and reliable, and not used for political purposes. And that is. My hope as an American, I mean, I do not in any way like to see that be misused.
Well, I recall the Iraq War. Talk about intelligence being misused. I mean, so how do you make the judgment about what Bush and Cheney did to the country compared to what this guy's Snowden's doing?
Well, I appeared on MSNBC, and Bush had just made the statement, which was an outright lie, that that Congress had viewed all the intelligence that went into the decision that he and Cheney made. I mean, that's just ludicrous. The Congress is not an originator of intelligence. It's just the consumer. It just reads the bare outlines, the bare, summary reports, period. So, I mean, there was no intelligence, and anybody in the intelligence community knew that. By 1991, the Iraqis had gotten rid of their WMD. I talked to senior Air Force generals who told me about the fact that the Iraqis had buried their last nuclear artillery missiles out in the desert, and they were kept under the protection of tribes, and they all disintegrated. So.
Well, look, yeah. I'm afraid we're run out of time here today, Richard Sale, but I thank you very much for joining us.
Yeah, well, you've been very polite. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Again, I've been... You too. Again, I've been speaking with Richard Sale, who's been reporting on intelligence since the late 1970s. He was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize and is the author of Clinton's Secret Wars. He regularly posts for the blog Sic Semper Tyrannis about national security and foreign policy, and he has an article at truthout.org, Afghanistan, A Dark and Fragile Future. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about freedom of the press in Ecuador, assuming that that is the final destination for Edward Snowden. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Carlos Loria, who is the Senior Americas Program Coordinator at the Committee to Protect Journalists, where he serves as Chief Strategist and Spokesperson on press freedom issues in the Americas. He monitors and documents press freedom violations in Latin America and has led missions to Mexico, Colombia, Guatemala, Venezuela, Ecuador, Bolivia, Nicaragua, Haiti, Brazil, El Salvador, and Argentina. He serves on the board of the Maria Moores Cabot Award for Excellence in Latin American Journalism, which is sponsored by the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism. Welcome to Background Briefing, Carlos Loria.
Hello, it's a pleasure to be with you.
And it does appear that the fugitive from the U.S., the ex-contractor for the NSA, Edward Snowden, even though he didn't get on his plane in Moscow for Havana, he was booked on a plane, he didn't show up. The assumption is that he's in custody of the Russians, which would probably be the KGB, or the SVR, as they're now called, and he's probably being debriefed, but he is supposedly going to end up in Ecuador. That seems to be the consensus. But isn't there an irony that WikiLeaks, of course, are helping him and probably arrange for his ending up in Ecuador because, after all, Julian Assange is in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. So just give me a sense of the status of press freedom in Ecuador, given that WikiLeaks are the champions of press freedom. At the same time, their champions, in the case of the government of Correa in Ecuador, appear to be less than friendly to the press.
Exactly right. It's a great irony, because the decision comes at a time when freedom of expression is under siege in Ecuador. In fact, the president has just signed into law a piece of legislation that the government argues would give more access to information and would democratize the media. But in fact, our review of this legislation views this law as a regulation that will give wide discretion to the new regulatory agency to both impose arbitrary sanctions and censor the press for example, Ecuadorian journalists are really shocked about one of the provisions that prohibits media lynching. This is Article 26 of this communications law, and they define media lynching as, quote, the dissemination of concerted and reiterative information with the purpose of undermining the prestige of a person or a legal entity. And, you know, this provision, media outlets that found violating this provision could be ordered to issue public apologies and would be subject to criminal and civil sanctions that are not specified in the law. Problem is that the legislation is filled with these provisions that are both ambiguous, imprecise, and that can really open the door for government censorship, especially a government that has made of its confrontation with the media almost a state policy.
So Rafael Correa, the leader of Ecuador, is incredibly popular, though, isn't he? He was just elected, I think, by a landslide.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, he's extremely popular. He was reelected in February, but you know, his record, you know, as documented by regional, local, and international press freedom organization, is dismal. I mean, apart from this law, you know, Ecuador and Correa himself had filed a record of defamation lawsuits both in civil and criminal courts as a means of intimidating critics. You know, and people may remember the case of a leading newspaper, El Universo, whose directors were sentenced to 3 years in jail and the paper to pay a total of $40 million in damages, and a complaint that stemmed from an opinion column in 2011. And later, Correa himself pardoned the paper, but the message was sent for those who write critical op-eds. Something similar happened to the two of the most important investigative reporters who wrote a book about corruption scandal involving a brother of President Correa, Fabricio, and contracts with the state. And the only people prosecuted for this case were the journalists themselves, who were sentenced to pay $1 million in damages after the president himself asked for $10 million in damages for alleging that his reputation had been damaged. He pardoned the journalists together with the directors of El Universo after, you know, an outcry, international public opinion.
Again, I'm speaking with Carlos Loria, who's the Senior Americas Program Coordinator at the Committee to Protect Journalists, where he serves as Chief Strategist and Spokesperson on Press Freedom Issues in the Americas. He monitors and documents press freedom violations in Latin America and has led missions to Mexico, Colombia, Guatemala, Venezuela, Ecuador, Bolivia, Nicaragua, Haiti, Brazil, El Salvador, and Argentina. So tell me about this board that President Correa of Ecuador has set up, a five-member council for the regulation and development of information and communication, which is led by a personal representative of the president to oversee the news media. What kind of influence is that? I mean, it's pretty extraordinary that you'd have such a thing in the first place in a free country.
Exactly. I mean, this is a body that will basically regulate what Correa has called access from media outlets and will have, you know, broad powers to sanction and censor the press. And, you know, the text of the law, if you find other provisions, you know, it's filled with provisions that are really broad. For example, there's an article that says that states that people have the right to verified, contrasted, precise, and contextualized public information. This is according to many people, but to international instruments on freedom of expression, it's a contradiction. The Declaration of Principles on Freedom of Expression of the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights states that prior conditioning of expressions such as truthfulness, timeliness, or impartiality is incompatible with the right to freedom of expression. But it not only contradicts international standards, also constitutional guarantees on freedom of expression. So it's a 44-page law, contains 119 articles, you know. When I was discussing this with advocates and Ecuadorian journalists, it was difficult for them to find out which was the worst of these provisions, since they view nearly all of them as grave violations to press freedom.
And again, I'm speaking with Carlos Loria, who's the Senior Americas Program Coordinator at the Committee to Protect Journalists. We're talking about President Correa of Ecuador and his relationship to the press and the extent to which he won in a landslide recently and has passed draconian laws to muzzle the press, to monitor the press, and a law that prohibits media lynching, which can be defined loosely as insulting a politician, for example, like himself. So how would this compare, for example, to Hugo Chavez, who only recently, the Chavistas finally seem to have captured almost all of the media now in Venezuela. But for the longest time, of course, there was some fairly vigorous private media that opposed Chavez, but systematically he's managed to close them all down. And finally, the final one, Global Vision, has been bought out by cronies of the Chavistas. So now there's virtually no opposition press left in Venezuela. And of course, Venezuela is the other possible destination for Edward Snowden that the WikiLeaks people are escorting, or at least at this point, as I've mentioned, he may well be being debriefed by the successor agency to the KGB, the SVR, in Moscow. But presumably at some point or other, he's going to end up in Ecuador. So give us the comparison then between what Correa has managed to do in a very short period of time in Ecuador compared to what Hugo Chavez was able to do over his 14-year tenure.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, I think that you've mentioned it there in your question. You know, the state of press freedom in Venezuela, you know, it's dismal. You know, has to do with, you know, 14 years of confrontation where progressively the media, private media, has been breaking down by an array of legislation, by harsher penalties for defamation in the penal code, by political decisions to get rid of, you know, the most critical opposition channel, which has the largest audience. I'm talking about RCTV, which was off the air after its concession was not renewed in May of 2007. It's a political decision by Chavez himself. And it's difficult to compare, you know, between countries, but, you know, there's been some similarities in the tactics employed by Correa in Ecuador. And, you know, there hasn't been any closures, any shutdowns of media, although, you know, there were a few stations, radio stations, a dozen of those in last year whose concessions were not renewed, and some of them were arbitrarily closed for most of them critical of the government before their appeal process was finished. This happened in Ecuador. But, you know, yeah, there's a tendency to us in Venezuela to describe critics as members of the opposition. There's a tendency to use defamation provisions to target critics. And following the footsteps of Hugo Chavez, Correa has also built vast network of media outlets, basically doing propaganda. You know, it's in Venezuela, it has been called the communication hegemony, a muscular network of media to build initially to challenge the influence of private media, but then become, you know, as more and more investment was made, really protagonist in terms of the airwaves, as other channels, private channels, had to cut critical programming. Some of the other channels were off the air, like RCTV. So Correa has built this vast network of media, and it's not only used to transmit propaganda, but as a platform to smear critics and to advance the government's narrow political agenda.
So with the death of Chavez, has Correa assumed the mantle as the new Chavez in terms of being a leftist, a Latin American leader who, you know, obviously wins popularity by being opposed to the United States. I mean, obviously, this man is popular. He just got reelected by a landslide. I think they have, about 100 out of the 140 seats in the National Assembly, don't they?
Exactly. And that's what allowed them to pass the law with their majority in the National Assembly without even debating it. They just voted for the law. So, yeah, I think the analysis is right. I think, you know, Correa is trying to move in that direction to gain, obviously, popularity at home by, you know, opposing the U.S., but also, you know, in this circumstance, he's trying to clean the image of the government after, you know, this repressive tactics against the media, and trying to show, you know, first by giving Julian Assange
asylum.
Yeah, exactly. And now with, you know, if this comes through, if Snowden is finally getting asylum in Ecuador, this will be another attempt by Ecuador to clean its image that has been damaged clearly. But I think that the international community is not fooled. And an example is that, for example, in the Universal Periodic Review that took place in August last year in the United Nations Council, there were 70 member states that drafted recommendations urging Ecuador to improve the state of press freedom in the country. Obviously, that the government response was usual when it does to any objection. They responded with disdain. And basically, the Minister of Foreign Affairs said that there was ignorance behind the international criticism.
But I understand in 2009, Correa closed down a U.S. military base, and then in 2011, he kicked out a bunch of high-ranking diplomats, declaring the U.S. ambassador person non grata after WikiLeaks published State Department cables alleging corruption in Ecuador in the government. So at some point or other, how long can he be opposed to the United States at the same time have the U.S. the biggest trading partner? And I imagine a lot of the trade is in oil, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, that's a question that maybe a political analyst can answer. But, you know, what I'll say is that, you know, Korea has not only battled the United States, but also, you know, any intergovernmental body that has objected his anti-press policies. And an example of this is his battle and his fight to neutralize the work of the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights based in D.C. and its Special Rapporteur on Freedom of Expression. And, you know, the Ecuadorian government has led an effort followed by members of the ALBA bloc, including Venezuela, Nicaragua, Bolivia, to dismantle the office of the Special Rapporteur after the Special Rapporteur issued annual reports and recommendations and press releases, you know, criticizing the government for its actions against the press. Fortunately, you know, these attempts have failed. But the debate is ongoing, and you know the government has really decided to make this an issue before the Organization of American States, and will keep pressing for changes that you know may in the end cause damage to you know the human rights body of the U.S., which has been a model in terms of promoting and protecting press freedom in the Americas, in the Western Hemisphere.
Well, just in closing, Carlos Loria, since you monitor freedom of the press, particularly in Latin America, how do you see the evolution of this group, WikiLeaks? And of course, you know, Julian Assange is holed up in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. Edward Snowden is apparently going to end up in Ecuador. So the issue of freedom of the press for WikiLeaks is a valid one, given that WikiLeaks claims to be a champion of freedom of the press and open information and exposing government secrets, all of which is obviously welcomed by journalists. But the question remains is, who are these secrets ending up with? If the secrets that Snowden have end up with the KGB or the SVR, and if they've already, Chinese intelligence has already downloaded everything he's got on these thumb drives, and the leaders of this organization end up being protected by governments that are anti-American, then it leads you to question how unbiased WikiLeaks has become, whether it's no longer a neutral champion for press freedoms, but it's taking a political position.
Well, I mean, we have said already that Julian Assange and the WikiLeaks organization have been an assertive force in promoting the free flow of information, and also that we are against him being prosecuted with the Espionage Act. You know, would be a terrible precedent for press freedom around the world. But, you know, this, the fact that, you know, a government like the Ecuadorian government, which has, you know, one of the worst press freedom record in the Americas in terms of government repression, is first giving asylum to Assange in the embassy in London, and now thinking about the possibility of also giving asylum to Edward Snowden, it's clearly an irony. It comes at a time, again, when freedom of expression is under siege. And by providing asylum to both Assange and to Snowden, this won't change at all the repressive conditions facing Ecuadorian journalists who want to report critically about government policies and practices. So it would be good both for, I assume Assange knows this well, but for someone like Snowden to know that the country that he may be ending up in asylum is not clearly, is far from being a champion on freedom of expression. And in fact, is, according to our research, one of the worst in the Americas.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Carlos Loria.
You're very welcome. Thank you for your attention on this matter.
Again, I'm speaking with Carlos Loria, who's a senior Americas program coordinator at the Committee to Protect Journalists, where he serves as chief strategist and spokesperson on press freedom issues in the Americas. He monitors and documents press freedom violations in Latin America and has led missions to Mexico, Colombia, Guatemala, Venezuela, Ecuador, Bolivia, Nicaragua, Haiti, Brazil, El Salvador, and Argentina. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. The headline written down.